Let's begin this morning with the business of restaurants. The polar vortex really did a number on Chicago restaurants, and many diners stayed at home. Restaurant expert Doug Roth is here this morning. Doug is the founder and CEO of Playground Hospitality in Chicago. And Doug, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be back, as always.
Hungry as always, and your arriving this morning to talk about food is not going to help any.
Well, that's my job.
Yeah. I want to talk about some trends in the restaurant business, and we'll get into some of those, but the last couple of months have been pretty hard for restaurants, haven't they?
Ugly. Actually, January with the polar vortex was annihilating for a lot of restaurants. And in fact, if you take a look, January had quite a few fallouts. In the meantime, February was a little bit better, and then March at this point is a little bit flat. So we're hoping to dig out as we approach spring.
The vortex was just brutal. I mean, most people probably don't even remember it, but it was like 50 below. The wind chills were 50 below. That's not the weather you want to go out and eat in.
No, not necessarily, but it sure does appeal to having beef stew and some of the items that are, you know, stick to your ribs kind of food. So at least if you were able to either prepare that at home or get that by delivery.
Do we expect that pounding of the restaurants in that month of January and part of February, is that going to damage them moving forward, or is there a chance to kind of win some back a little?
I think what happens when you have that type of weather, that if anything, especially knowing Chicago, that you get cabin fever, and as soon as we have a day in the 60s, you'll see the dining chairs out, you'll see rooftops open, and you'll see people clamoring for sun, as they've been probably suffering from light affect disorder. So my feeling is at this point is that we're going to have a real strong spring as long as weather cooperates with us.
And so that will help these restaurants make up
huge.
That?
Yes,
difference.
Big time.
Yeah. You said there were a couple of that fell out. Some restaurants fell out, actually closed.
The restaurants that have closed or have moved. It's a good transition period as well. It's a good time to open very slowly restaurants at this point and sort of do slow openings and then prepare for spring. It's a good time to remodel. Lake Colonial, for instance, I understand, which was over on Rush, has moved just down the street, and it's supposed to be absolutely gorgeous. Great place to go as well.
There is an article that we found in Food and Wine that talked to some of the best chefs. They described them as forward-thinking chefs around the country to talk about what the trends are. And it's not surprising because a lot of people have already started doing this in their own diets, more plant-based things on the menu.
Plant-based is really hot. You can go to places like Epic Burger, which is obviously you think of as a hamburger restaurant, and they have a plant-based hamburger. Doing extremely well, made with beets, really good product. And I think what you'll be seeing more and more in restaurants, plant-based. Also, I think you'll be seeing more marijuana-based products as well, actually both from a bar standpoint and ultimately from a food standpoint. There certainly is already dessert products that are in that particular genre. So it's changing. And I think as people become certainly more concerned about diet, that you'll be seeing more items that are in that area.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up marijuana because we recently on the program talked to the Illinois Restaurant Association CEO, and he said that restaurants have been gearing up for that, the legalization of recreational marijuana in the state. And when I was doing the interview, it kind of struck me because I'm like, I didn't even think about that. But yeah, this is going to be a restaurant thing. You're going to be able to go in and buy, what, a brownie or something?
Oh, I think you'll have many different items, everything from beginning with, as I said, with cocktails all the way through dessert.
Yeah.
And breads and everything else that may have some sort of form of cannabis.
Is that going to be good or bad, do you think? Because the debate, there's a really heavy debate about whether or not we should be doing this or not.
You know, I'm not the right person to ask
right.
for that.
Okay.
I really not. Personally, I can see how it can obviously be a huge benefit, and we're already seeing it certainly from the standpoint as you look at different stocks that are trading today two or three times what their value was a year ago. And so from an economic standpoint, I just can't tell you at this point what the medical effect is when someone becomes necessarily too high And now, does it become, which is sort of an interesting thought, no different than in with alcohol,
right.
Does the restaurant become responsible if that person gets in an accident, as they do today with alcohol?
Yeah.
So we are responsible if we've overserved someone. What happens if we overserve someone in using marijuana? I don't know.
Yeah, it feels like it's headed in the same direction as that. And it also makes you think, too, you know, it's hard for a restaurant to survive without a liquor license. Is it going to become hard for a restaurant not to have this on their menu and still be viable?
Yeah. Very good point.
Yeah.
I think that the fact is, yes, it's very difficult for restaurants to make it without liquor because obviously the profit margin in spirits is huge. I'm not exactly certain what the profit margin would be with legalized marijuana.
You mentioned the plant-based burger. There's also on this list, from Food and Wine, kelp is going to become a big, or is already pretty hot in some restaurants. The idea that you can go and eat something that the whales eat in the ocean, right?
Yes. I have to say that there is different preparations of kelp that's out there today. I haven't necessarily tried it in the sense that it isn't that appealing to me, but I think what kale has been, that maybe kelp is sort of the next, and I think it's more of a fad. A lot of the trends that you do see are solid, you know, moving forward. One item, for instance, is I think there's certainly a new revelation with French cooking again. Going back to some of the classics and then going back to bistros, which I've known well over the years. And I'm really pleased to see that that's coming back again. But I don't know of what's going to be the vegetable of the year or the week or the month. And I think kelp might be one of them. I think, you know, I think we sort of try to reach out at times just to do something different. But it doesn't mean necessarily that it's here to stay.
We've talked many times about fast casual. This list says fast casual everything. So the food halls, this notion that you can go and get luxury food fast and eat it fast is pretty popular.
Fast casual is where to be. If I was to do a restaurant again, I would do a fast casual restaurant for lots of reasons. One is obviously economics. Two is being versatile. And three is the opportunity to hone in on certain different types of cultures. And you're going to be seeing Indian, and there's more Korean. There's certainly more Asian in fast casual now than ever before. Areas that have been sort of carved out by certain players like Panera and others, now you're getting a real sense of diversity. And as you mentioned with food halls, there is Time Out that just announced that they had 18 chefs that are going to be opening on the west side. Their new food hall, which is going to look like it's going to be off the charts.
You mentioned French cooking, but Latin American cooking is on the list as well. There's been a revival of that, whether it be from Cuba or Venezuela or Mexico. People love their Latin American cooking.
Well, I think people love to feel transported. And when you have an opportunity, especially with the vision of places that are fun, like those particular regions, the food's fun too. And so as a result, I think that that makes it really special in that sort of context. So I look forward to those type of foods because they're fun to eat.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, you know, if you can take a 15-minute break to Costa Rica, why not?
Also on the list is more sourcing transparency. People want to know where the food comes from that they're eating, whether it be from a local region or from a place that is climate sensitive, that the, you know, people are interested in how, for instance, if it comes from a place that doesn't do self-sustaining stuff, people want to know all that stuff now.
Well, when we say people,
diners, yeah.
No, that's true. And really the origin for that are millennials, and they really started that process of making it very, very important, of understanding sourcing. I think we've discussed before, and which is really interesting, that farm-to-table, organic, those are now commonplace as we talk today. They're embedded. It's a given. But what is important, and started with millennials and has rolled over to different market segments and age segments, is the idea of how is that cow taken care of? Where is it from? And almost to the point, who's its mother? So, I mean, it is something that's gotten very important, very serious, and for a lot of diners. And I get it, and I think that it's something that's here to stay.
We've been talking a lot about eating out, but eating in is just as popular as eating out these days. You have any kind of mix of to-go items, meal prep packages? People are doing cooking at home, having potlucks, and it's growing more so than I think I would expect it to see it. How are restaurants handling that?
Well, what's been interesting is you sort of spoke about two different areas. One is restaurants themselves who are using the delivery services. And what's happening is there's a shakeout now. You have Uber Eats, you have Grubhub, and you have a couple others that are really the main players at this point. There are others that are starting to fall behind. And it's a difficult economic thing for restaurants, because what you're doing is, let's say you have $100 that you have bought in food. The restaurant is selling it to, let's say, Uber Eats for $80. And then Uber Eats takes that $20 and then adds an additional delivery fee to that. And that's how they're making their profit. The restaurant, which is already on tight margins, is having to play in the game because everyone else is playing in the game at this point. But it becomes very, very difficult to make carryout work for them when you're using a third party. On the other side that you just discussed a second ago was, what are some of those companies that are bringing in home cooking? One I know that's having problems is Blue Apron, where they basically deliver the raw product and you sort of sit there and put together your meal. But as we were talking before the show, I believe that there's one that you're aware of that is really very, very high-end in the sense that it's geared towards multiple individuals or a single individual.
Yeah, I'm doing the Tavala. I bought the Tavala oven, and the meals come ready. I don't have to do any preparation. I just put them in the oven. They've already been prepared. Alex Plotkin, former chef, I think, at Noma and some other places, he's their chief culinary officer. And, Doug, I have to tell you, this is some of the best eating I've done in the last 20 years. These are restaurant-quality meals that go into the oven, and they're done in like 20 minutes, and I have a nice meal. I'm sold on it.
Well, you just said it. The fact is that you're sold on it, and that's what needs to happen. And by the fact that they have been able to hone in on flavors, taste buds, mm-hmm. And basically from the standpoint of delivery, how is it delivered for you? Is it delivered?
It comes in so at the beginning of the week, I get a box of all the meals that are in separate packages, and it comes in a cooled container. And, you know, they're good for about a week, and I can put them in the refrigerator and use one every day.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
And I happen to have met with Alex before and know his family just by coincidence that you've mentioned it. And I got to tell you, he's a very talented guy.
Yeah, and for $12, each one of them is $12. And that's better than I can do going to a food bar or going out. So it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it's the sweet spot that these companies have to get to, right? For a mix of all of the good things.
Exactly. But what you just said, for $12, I think it's pretty difficult. You can't go to Whole Foods or Jewel almost for that standpoint and get something for $12 and have a meal that you feel satisfied with. I mean, they're coming in at a great price point, and it's fully prepared. And most importantly is, it's something that you're satisfied with.
You mentioned, again, before we started talking today, that you are speaking to students, going to New Orleans to talk about some of this, the culinary schools. Is this stuff that they're being taught, or how are they being prepared for all of this new stuff?
Well, they're not.
Yeah.
From what I've seen so far, there are many culinary schools in the country, probably somewhere about 50 that are major. One thing that we're doing today, and when I say we're, I'm involved with Tulane University, my alma mater. We are beginning a hospitality school, which I'm chairing. And our feeling is just what you're saying, is that there's so many aspects today that aren't necessarily being addressed in culinary schools. We want to make it more exponential, or the sense of more hands-on. Mm-hmm. We want to make situations where we're teaching not only about technology, which you're talking about today as well, which is not a strong component. What has been before was the balance sheet, and you know, how do you basically get a great food cost, and how do you get a great labor cost. We're interested in those aspects of the rudiments, but there's a whole wide world of what we call hospitality that's outside of what even is applicable to creating managers in hotels, managers in restaurants. What we're interested in at this point is creating a sense of culture and understanding what your needs are individually, Steve, what you are about as a person, and creating that special moment for you and how you do that both in that industry and no differently than going to see your doctor. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm recommending at this point, I don't know if they're going to listen to this or not, is that every med student, law student, engineering student, at least at Tulane, is required to take a course in hospitality so that they know how to deal both with a patient. You may be dealt with in a different way than I am, mm-hmm, when it comes to hearing, unfortunately, a prognosis, and how to understand how to deal differently, but also how to set a culture in their offices as well. I think we've all experienced before, especially your listeners as well, of how unfortunately backwards sometimes medicine can be.
Yeah.
And going
cold,
to see a lawyer.
And sometimes cold, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It can be brutal. And the fact is the differentiator is going to be those people who are better educated in how to handle the differentiation in people. And that's where it's really going in education, in the hospitality industry, in the food industry, and almost every industry. It's honing in on your point of difference.
Doug, always great conversation with you. Thanks for coming in today. We'll see you next time.
I look forward to it.
Doug Roth, the founder and CEO of Playground Hospitality. Make sure you check him out online at playgroundhospitality.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to The Opening Bell. Wednesday edition, first quarter earnings season is about to get underway fully in earnest as more companies begin reporting quarterly results. A couple of those companies already out of the gate in first quarter. We thought we'd bring in Shiraz Bian this morning, research director at Zacks Equity Research. Zacks.com is where you can find Shiraz and his colleagues. Shiraz, good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be back.
I mentioned that some companies are already reporting earnings. How is it shaping up?
It's still too early, Steve, to get a good sense of how the entire reporting cycle will shape up. But of the few companies that we have seen, the picture isn't that impressive. Growth is coming down, and the overall tone and substance of guidance, which is how the business conditions are shaping up in the current and coming quarters, has been on the weak side as well.
So how weak, I guess, is the big question there. What are some of the concerning phrases or sentences from some of these reports on guidance?
So one of the recurring themes that we have been hearing from management over the last many quarters, which continues this earnings season as well, are worries surrounding trade and the effect that has on sentiment as well as on business. And then another factor that has been clouding the outlook is inflationary pressures on a number of inputs. So these are material expenses, these are payroll expenses, these are transportation expenses, and the sum total of that, in addition to these trade worries, have been weighing on corporate margins, and that's what we are seeing both in the actual results as well as estimates for the bulk of the companies coming up, that margins are under pressure. Even though revenue growth is decent, it's not going as far as they used to in the recent past.
And so, Shiraz, what is the real-world effect of that going to be on shares and on the market, do you think?
The Fed came through after we had the major sell-off in the last quarter. quarter of 2018, when the market was worried about all these factors, and it was concerned that the Fed appeared to be unconcerned with these slowdown in economic growth globally and the effect that was going to have on corporate profitability. And the change in Fed tune and the policy direction is what has been keeping stocks higher. Had it not been for the change in Fed posture, I believe in the market we would be in trouble. We would be having the red that we saw through Christmas in the last 2-3 months of the year. So the corporate profits, which were a major source of support for the stock market over the last few years, appears to have gone away. It's no longer there.
Again, at Zacks.com, and you put together an outstanding report on all of this. There's a couple of graphics there, and I know it's hard to sort of relate these to our listening audience, but I'll try. As we look at quarterly earnings growth year over year, actual and estimated, it's quite dramatic how, let's say, second quarter of 18, it was 25.4%, and quarter one now minus 3%. So that's a big downturn.
That's correct. So what happened last year was that in addition to underlying internal fundamental momentum in the U.S. economy as well as the global economy, we got this one-time huge boost from the corporate tax cut, which practically, by our estimate, doubled the earnings growth pace in 2018. So in the first 3 quarters of 2018, growth was close to 25%. It dropped down to about 14-15% in the last quarter of the year. But not only that one-time boost is no longer there in 2019, but on top of that, you have these global macro economic growth worries, which has been a further drag. So you're correct, growth in Q1 19 is expected to be down 3.7% earnings growth, even though the revenue growth is expected to be close to 5%. This will be, in fact, the first earnings decline for the S&P 500 index since the second quarter of 2016.
Nine of the 16 Zacks sectors will see negative territory, growth expected to be in negative territory, autos, basic materials, energy, and I'm looking at tech and finance here too. Talk to us a little bit about some of these different sectors and the ones that you expect to take the biggest hits.
So energy is the clearest of all of them. It's a function of how energy prices have been. They benefited from easy comparisons and the steady rise in oil prices. Those comparisons have turned around now, and that's why we are seeing negative growth. The technology is the most consequential. Also, finance, not only because they are the biggest earnings contributors for the index, but technology is also a major growth driver. And on the technology side, there is this cyclical downturn in this very key industry in technology, the semiconductors, the chips industry. So very tough comparisons there. Many other sub-industries within the technology space are also facing the headwinds that we touched on earlier. So those are the issues in the broader tech space. And as you know, tech has been a major growth driver for the market as a whole and also for corporate earnings. Finance is a victim of what's happening with interest rates. And as we mentioned earlier, with the Fed changing its policy posture and sitting on the sidelines, interest rates have been coming down, and that's a big drag on financial margins.
So how should investors prepare for this or arrange their portfolios in a way where they get the least negative exposure from what we might see coming?
So the most important thing, Steve, always is for investors to be looking beyond the immediate. If they are investing for the long term, they should be looking at companies with good corporate profitability, sustainable profitability, and large companies that have defendable market shares, sustainable growth, decent margins, and those companies should remain in good condition whether the profitability cycle is on the up or on the down. And particularly if we are moving towards the later stages of the cycle, companies that have plenty of cash flow, companies that have solid balance sheets, companies that are not weighed down by debt, they should remain flexible and in good condition, even when the financing and credit conditions are not as permissive as they have been in the recent past.
Shiraz, always good information. We appreciate you being with us this morning.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Shiraz Mian from Zacks Equity Research, where he's the research director there. Again, you can find the latest at Zacks.com, and we'll also link out to Shiraz's latest analysis on some of this in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later this morning at WGNRadio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, looks like it's a weak open on Wall Street a little bit later on this morning. Dow futures off nearly 66 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures off a fraction as well. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Wheat futures at the Board of Trade moved slightly lower yesterday as investors took profits after prices hit a one-month high on optimism of wheat exports and the adverse weather in the U.S. threatening to delay the planting of spring wheat, particularly in the number one producing state, North Dakota. Soybean and corn futures also fell on technical selling yesterday. Just a quick look at the trends at the close. The July wheat contract unchanged. July corn down 3.25. July soybeans down 6.25. Turning to livestock futures, the live cattle market retreated on technical selling and fund liquidation yesterday, and the closing prices there found the June lean hog contract down 65 cents a hundredweight, June live cattle down 37 cents a hundredweight, April feeder cattle up 17 cents. Maybe a breakthrough in the battle against African swine fever. Progress by researchers in China have taken a major step toward finding a vaccine to prevent African swine fever. And coming up this week, of course, we have the report from the USDA on planting intentions for this year, and also the quarterly grain stocks report. They will be issued at 11 o'clock on Friday morning. That's your money on 720 WGN.
Thanks, Orion. We have a couple more stories here before we leave you this morning. One involves Chicago-based McDonald's will no longer take part in efforts to lobby against raising the minimum wage at the federal, state, or local level. That is according to Politico in a report this morning. Apparently, McDonald's vice president of U.S. government relations said in a letter to the National Restaurant Association that the company believes wage increases should be phased in and that all industries should be treated the same way. The letter went on to say that the conversation about wages is an important one. It's one that we wish to advance, we McDonald's, not impede. The fast food chain also stated that outlets owned by the company have an average starting wage that exceeds $10 per hour, while franchisees pay likely similar wages in their own restaurants. McDonald's has not immediately responded to this report. Shares of McDonald's up nearly 1% yesterday at $187.48. This morning down just a fraction in the pre-market. Citigroup is starting a new payments unit that will offer payment options, including credit cards, digital wallets, and direct bank account transfers. The Wall Street Journal reports Citigroup is partnering with payments firms, including MasterCard, which will provide some back-end connections and messaging for merchants. The new payments unit is expected to help Citigroup compete with companies like PayPal, Stripe, with some internet companies, which some internet companies generally prefer. A House Banking Committee expected to pass a bill to get marijuana industry cash off the streets and into bank accounts today. The so-called SAFE Act would allow banks to provide services to cannabis companies that follow state laws. The House Financial Services Committee scheduled to debate the SAFE Act this afternoon. Banking industry analysts say that while the House is open to considering and even passing bills like this one, the Senate figures to be a hard sell. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reportedly is not interested in debating weed on the Senate floor. And now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Wednesday, March the 27th. The nation's trade balance in January leads off economic reports. Analysts are expecting a deficit of $57 billion, down from a deficit of nearly $60 billion in December. The fourth quarter budget deficit set to be released today as well. Economists see the widening deficit widening to $130 billion from just under $125 billion. In the third quarter. Also today on the calendar, the mortgage applications from the Mortgage Bankers Association, the State Street Investor Confidence Index, the EIA Petroleum Status Report, a couple of Fed speakers out there as well that could move markets. On the earnings calendar, Lululemon Athletica will release earnings, quarterly earnings today. Again, just some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, March the 27th.